Good afternoon. From Aspen Public Radio, I'm Allison Bechtesh. This is Airtime, in-depth conversations with interesting people. This week, the power and healing of telling your story, the thoughts behind a new mission from the Aspen Skiing Company, and a deeper understanding of wildfires. Thanks for tuning in to Aspen Public Radio's new show, Airtime. Stay tuned. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Response, a local organization working to end abuse, is marking the occasion with a community storing event tomorrow night. Arts and culture reporter Kristen Kay spoke with Executive Director Shannon Meyer about the power in survivors telling their stories. Meyer also discussed what the organization has seen in the year since the Me Too movement grabbed headlines and during Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation hearing earlier this month.
It's been 1 year since Me Too kind of exploded. From your perspective, what's different, if anything, locally?
Response saw a big uptick in calls to our crisis line in 2017. So in 2017, we received 260 calls to our 24-hour crisis helpline, which, by the way, is 925-SAFE. You know, we can't directly predict what that was related to, but it was twice as many calls as the year before. So something changed. And I don't have the numbers yet for 2018, since we're only in October. But we've definitely been having consistent calls and consistent people walking in the door. And, you know, in the last week with this current news cycle, we've had a lot of people who are survivors who are triggered by what they're seeing in the news, who are showing up and saying, I just want to talk to somebody about how this feels for me right now.
Certainly some things coming up with Kavanaugh, I'm sure, are triggering survivors. So what are you guys hearing?
I think that it's important to remember that this behavior, as we see from when these accusations are made from, has been around for a really long time. I hear people saying, you know, this is getting out of hand. It's been out of hand. What has changed is that people are getting more comfortable coming forward. I was just listening to an episode of Hidden Brain on the way over here, and it was talking about the concept of social proof. And that people look around and see what happens to other people when they talk about something that's happened to them, whether it's as a society or as an individual. And for a long time, social proof was telling survivors if they come forward, they won't be believed, they'll be bullied, they'll lose their job. Various re-traumatizing things will happen to them, so they stay quiet. And while I will say that this year of Me Too has been re-traumatizing for a lot of people, it's changing that dynamic of social proof, and people are seeing that they come forward, and we won't always have the best results, as we just saw, but the more and more we see people coming forward, the more people will find that that's acceptable. And I do feel like it's tipping the balance. I know that it might not feel that way, but if you look at the longer arc of time, it is tipping the balance.
I want to talk more about national events and what the response from response has been. Are you doubled down on your mission? Are you discouraged?
You know, as I said, it's been very triggering time in the news for people who are survivors or people just who are empathetic beings who are watching what's going on. But for us, since part of our mission is really looking forward to a time where our community will have no domestic violence, no sexual assault, and we'll have zero tolerance for that in our community, it really has reinforced our need to be in the schools, teaching our children to have healthy relationships, to know what it means to reference sexual consent, to know what dating violence looks like and to keep themselves safe and their friends safe. I hear a lot of reluctance from parents to have a conversation about sexual assault, about sexual consent, about what's going on in the media. And this is absolutely the age, you know, young teenagers and up, that they need to be hearing about this, not just from us in the schools, but from their parents at home.
Let's talk about this storytelling event on the 18th. What is the power of storytelling when it comes to these issues? Why take this approach as opposed to like bringing in the experts to talk about something?
Right. I think a lot of research has shown that people are moved by individual stories. And so it really has two purposes. One is for the community to see that these issues are out here. It may look very different than you expect. Domestic abuse is not always a black eye. Sometimes it's years of emotional abuse, financial isolation, other factors. I mean, of course, a lot of times it is violence, but people stereotype who becomes victimized in these situations. And I will say from our experience in this valley that it runs the gamut from every socioeconomic class, every race, every gender, every age. We see it all. And so putting faces and personal stories to those statistics is really helpful in helping people understand this could be happening to my neighbor. This could be happening to my aunt. This could be happening to my best friend. And these are some of the signs that I can look for. So we will be having five people tell their own very personal stories, from childhood abuse to domestic abuse situations to sexual assault situations. But our focus is really on how people worked through those situations, how they got help, how they are now thriving after having gone through some bad situations.
Talk to me about the range of storytellers. How did you find multiple stories and how did you encourage people to come forward in a very public way with their experiences?
So we really made sure not to pressure anyone at all. We kind of put it out there to say that this is something that we would like to do for the community. And we had some people who were clients of Response who we knew were comfortable kind of talking about their story because of where they were in their recovery. The idea actually came to me from a survivor who'd worked with Response before my time, and she'd told her story before through the Writ Large storytelling series. And she said, I think we could pull together other survivors like me who would be willing to tell their stories. So our youngest storyteller is 17, and we have four women and one man telling stories. So it's a real range of people. We have a story about stalking. We have story about childhood abuse. We have story about domestic abuse situations. And we will have a therapist from MindSprings at the event in case people find themselves triggered and want to talk to someone. But I really think the overall message of the event is going to be uplifting and educational. We're not hoping to re-traumatize anybody or have a really depressing night. We really want to just shine a light on this and the work that we're doing to make life better for a lot of people.
Yeah. I want to talk more about the implications for our community to see their neighbors go on stage and discuss domestic violence, abuse, assault. What is like the trickle-down effect of something like this that you're hoping for?
I would say our goals for the event are twofold or threefold, really. I didn't mention the benefit to the survivor because it is, I think, a large part of many people's healing process to get to a point where they can tell their story openly and have no stigma, no shame, and just be proud of where they are now. So that's one very important benefit for the storytellers. And I think we as a community benefit from being part of that experience for them. And then, of course, we want to get the word out there that this stuff does happen in our community, for community members who are not themselves victims, like I said, to recognize situations that friends of theirs, colleagues, coworkers, employees might be going through, and direct them to us if they need help. And then, of course, for survivors who are out there who may not even recognize that they're currently being victimized, to recognize something in one of those stories and be able to come to us for help.
That was Shannon Meyer speaking with reporter Kristen Kay. Meyer is the executive director of Response, a local organization that advocates for survivors of domestic and sexual abuse. The My Response storytelling event starts at 5 p.m. at the Wheeler tomorrow, October 18th. You are listening to Airtime on Aspen Public Radio, the conversations, questions, and issues that deserve more time. Stay tuned. Colorado's tourism office has updated its marketing campaign. At the unveiling of the slogan, Snow's Perfect State, last week in Denver, I caught up with tourism director Kathy Ritter. The motto and the office are both working to highlight reasons to visit Colorado that aren't related to skiing. Things like an arts loop tour in the Roaring Fork Valley.
By creating these loops, we're creating new traveler experiences. So people may be familiar with Aspen, and they may think Aspen is associated with ski, but when you start connecting Aspen with other experiences, cultural experiences, and linking it with other communities, you bring a whole new traveler to your destination, and you bring a year-round traveler to your destination.
How much is snow, a good or bad snow year, reliant, how much does Colorado's tourism fluctuate with that? I mean, we just saw it such a hard year.
You know, it's so interesting because we tracked the effects of our winter campaign last year, and it turned out that our winter campaign actually attracted more travelers to non-ski areas than to ski areas. So I was saying the last time I looked, I didn't see any ski slopes in Colorado Springs or Denver, but that's where a lot of our winter travelers went. So whether we have snow or not snow is certainly a factor in visitation in Colorado because many people do come here for the winter activities. But it's typically snowing somewhere in Colorado. Maybe the snow doesn't come on the schedule we would prefer, like last year. But we ended up with a lot of snow, you know, in later months of the year, March and April. But travelers do come to Colorado just because of the vibrant array of offerings in our state and the bright blue skies and our sunshine. It's a wonderful place to spend winter, whether there's snow or not.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Kathy Ritter, Director of Colorado's Tourism Office. Jeff Hanley, Vice President of Communications for the Aspen Skiing Company, was also in attendance at the event unveiling Colorado's new slogan. The new Give a Flake campaign for Aspen Skiing Company is a step further than the Aspen Way campaign the company ran last year. It embraces diversity and action against climate change. I ask him if it's received any backlash.
We certainly had comments and outreach. Nothing more than we thought we would get. Probably less than we thought we would get. So it's been exciting. I mean, it really has been for me. It's invigorating to see the people who have become engaged on either side, and we've had debate with people. Like, we're not telling you how you should feel or how you should vote. Please register to vote. Please become engaged. Please educate yourself, and then do what you think is right. Here's what we think is right. Here's what we think, and you may or may not agree. But at least be a part of the conversation and hopefully a civil conversation, not always.
You did get an award this week regarding this campaign, right? Or you were recognized for this along with other things?
So we were recognized by Ski Magazine as the top resort in the Western United States, which is exciting, and we're very happy about that. And Give a Flake was brought up as part of our, not just the campaign, but about our overall philosophy of business and outreach and standing up for what we believe in and believing that there are enough people and enough skiers and enough tourists that are gonna take that to heart and come and visit us because of that.
I would also think it makes it such a good place to work. To work at a place where the employees are jazz. This isn't just a business. This is something that's getting involved in my local community or that's getting involved in national politics. Like, my bosses are aware that there's life outside this company.
Yeah, you know what? That to me is one of the best things. And if we can attract and maintain a employee base that truly believes in what we feel or embraces what they feel and can represent that, it's going to be successful for the business because they're going to stay, they're going to tell their friends, they're going to seek us out. And you know, in this day and age, it's really hard to find employees. So we're fortunate to have ownership and management that says, you know what do we do for our employees? How can we make living in this community to do what we all want to do livable, because it's not easy, I'm sure you know. So when you have that, it's so exciting to be a part of that. And you know, if you talk to people in our sustainability department, they'll the first to admit, like, that wasn't my idea. That came from the guy in the vehicle maintenance shop. And that's so cool and so exciting to have that empowerment as an employee. Be like, I work on snowmobiles and they just took my idea and ran with it, you know. It's really cool, and I think it gives us you know, our philosophy is if we can keep our employees happy and engaged and living a really cool life in the mountains, that translate to business success.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you.
That was Aspen Skiing Company Vice President of Communications Jeff Hanley speaking about the company's new marketing campaign. In that campaign, Aspen Skiing Company is asking outdoor lovers or visitors to become activists. This season's marketing focuses on climate change and includes postcards urging three senators to take action. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy discussed what it means to step in the political arena with SkiCo Vice President of Sustainability, Auden Schendler.
I'm wondering if you can speak to the goals of that campaign.
Yeah. Well, just to give you a little history, our work in sustainability has evolved from greening up our own house and looking at our own carbon footprint to saying, hey, if we really care about this problem, we've got to work at a bigger scale. So then we said, how do we wield power that will drive scale change on this global problem? And this is part of the answer. We're trying to mobilize not just the ski industry, but the outdoor industry. The NRA has about 5.5 million members, and it's super powerful on policy. Well, REI alone has 17 million members. So the outdoor industry could be a massive political force, but it hasn't wielded power, and that's the vision here. Start pushing.
Okay, and so it's that same idea that SkiCo has a bit of a voice on a national stage and uses it both to pressure policy and to kind of ask other people in the ski industry to step up, other people in the outdoor industry to step up and do the same?
Yeah, others in the outdoor industry, but also specific elected officials. You know, we're targeting two ski state senators, Collins and Murkowski, who are the swing vote on many climate issues, who will be the swing vote on the Kavanaugh hearings, and who ought to care more about climate than they already do. So we think we can move them.
I'm wondering if pre-printed postcards coming from Colorado to senators that don't necessarily represent the people who are sending them in, I'm wondering how you know that impact or how you can anticipate that this will actually pressure and target those senators.
Bill McKibben says there's no silver bullet on climate, there's just silver buckshot. And what we're trying to do is create citizenship among people. If you pick up that card and read it, you're going to learn a lot about Rob Portman of Ohio. And you're going to learn a lot about how to engage as a citizen and educate yourself. And if you click on the webpage because you got intrigued, there are all kinds of other resources. So you're right. It probably doesn't have that much impact. But you got to push on this thing in a million different ways. It's a social movement, and we don't know precisely what's going to work.
That's interesting that you're saying while it is targeting these three senators, it is also targeting... It's also an education campaign for anybody who comes through Aspen Snowmass or who reads those magazines where they're
right.
Printed.
Yep.
This is being released as like an ad campaign, as a marketing campaign. And I'm wondering if there's like a financial goal or incentive or tie that SkiCo as a business has to hit too, or how you'll measure the success of if this is actually working for Aspen Skiing Company as well.
Yeah, I mean, marketing people have metrics like how many eyeballs, how many impressions, and so forth. And that's going to be how we look at it. But then, for me, the question is, did you drive change? And that's a much harder question. But again, this is a social movement, and it change is slow and evolutionary, and you have to push and push and push. So there's going to be on the ground, what changes? How are people talking about these issues? What other businesses are moving, like Nike has moved? And then what policy eventually changes?
Are there key policies or votes coming up that you see where you'd like to see the needle move?
Yeah, the 2018 election. By far the most important climate election now in history. And the first half of the campaign is targeted at getting the vote out from the outdoor industry.
So what will mean success in the 2018 election?
Taking the House and the Senate.
That was Auden Schendler, Aspen Skiing Company's Vice President of Sustainability. You are listening to Airtime on Aspen Public Radio. You can catch these conversations again online, aspenpublicradio.org. It's no secret that Colorado is wildfire country. And after a particularly active wildfire season, experts in the Roaring Fork Valley are thinking about what comes next. Gary Ferguson is the author of Land on Fire, which looks at how wildfires are changing and how communities can prepare. He spoke with Elizabeth Stewart-Severy.
So, Gary, Land on Fire describes how wildfires are changing across the West. Can you highlight some of the key changes that we're seeing in fire behavior?
Well, wildfires, in a nutshell, are burning hotter, much hotter. And by hotter, let's say about 2,000 or 2,100 degrees compared to the more common stand maintenance fires that historically the West had seen mostly, which would have burned about 1,300 degrees, so much hotter. And they're much bigger. We're having so-called megafires with some frequency, megafires being defined as a fire over 100,000 acres. We used to have those very, very infrequently, and since the year 2000, we've had about a dozen years with at least a dozen of those fires burning, so much bigger. And they're more dangerous. They're more dangerous because of certain conditions created by climate change, other conditions created by just the sheer size of the fires, making their own weather, and things like fire whirls, which are very dangerous to firefighters, but also because they're knocking on the door of wildland urban interface subdivisions, and that's the term that describes any place really where there's a structure near natural vegetation. So as those areas get developed, of course, the people who live there are in greater danger from the fires than they would have been 50 years ago.
You mentioned that climate change, some conditions created by climate change are contributing to this. What are some of the other factors that have contributed to fires getting bigger and hotter and more dangerous?
Well, from roughly 1915 until about 1980, in the West, our fire management agencies really believed that putting out fires as quickly as possible whenever they happened was the wise way to go. For a long time, fires were actually described as sort of the enemy and the foe, and the Forest Service for a while in the early 20th century actually had a policy called the 9 a.m. rule, where they tried to put any fire that started out by 9 the next morning. Mm-hmm. And some fires do need to be put out immediately, but the problem is that when you put them all out, you allow a fuel load, fallen trees and branches and timber, to essentially accumulate on the forest floor. And in the arid West, the only way that the biomass of those old trees gets turned back into soil to grow new life is through fire. So when you stop that fire, you make sure that fire load keeps building up bigger and bigger year after year after year. And so now when fires break out because of that fuel load, it's very, very difficult, especially when you combine it with the conditions of climate change, to put those fires out.
Is it fair then to think that fire on the landscape can be a good thing? Does this mean that prescribed fire might be part of the solution?
You're absolutely right. Fire is at base a very, very healthy thing. Besides it returning, as I mentioned, all the nutrients back to the soil so that that soil can create new life, it also has a lot to do with keeping pathogens and insect invasions at bay. Fires tend to burn in a checkerboard fashion, so you get uneven aged tree stands, and that makes for a healthier, more diverse set of environments for birds and mammals and other life. So fire is, at its heart, a very, very healthy thing, and part of us returning to a healthy forest landscape in the West will involve a prescribed burning plan.
But of course, people who have been in areas that are close to wildfires know the fear and the danger that these big and hot fires can present. Here in Pitkin County, people live here because of the proximity to wildlands, which puts much of Pitkin County in high danger of wildfire, much of Eagle and Garfield counties in high danger of wildfire. Do you have suggestions about how to balance this very human desire to live close to the mountains and fire-prone areas, kind of with that inherent danger of wildfire?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we all do love to live near natural areas. I use the term wildland-urban interface. That's a description that has to do with any structure, so a home that's near natural vegetation. And since about 2000, 40% of the development in the United States has been in the wildland-urban interface. If you want to live in the wildland-urban interface, though, there are some things that will help keep you safe without question. One is to have requirements for developers to build intelligently. Then there are some very basic things that can be done, such as kind of what firefighters call fire defense perimeters, where you just go around your home and within 10 feet of the perimeter of the house, you don't have any burnable material. You put fine mesh screen over your attic vents and your crawl space vents. You keep your gutters clean. The effect of these kinds of simple management tools is profound.
Now, I think here in the Roaring Fork Valley, the Lake Christine fire was the first big wildfire that we've seen in more than a decade. In the wake of a big wildfire, are there some key things that you advise communities to be thinking about or acting on while wildfire is really in the front of everybody's minds?
Yes, I think really to get together with folks with land management agencies and discuss, have we done what we need to do as far as keeping our communities safe? And have we, you know, engaged in thinning operations perhaps around the neighborhood that could also keep the perimeter of the entire neighborhood safe? It's also really important, I think, that the communities and the state as a whole does have intelligent development guidelines. Because to be honest, if a developer goes in and puts in a set of housing units and there isn't the proper ingress and egress, in other words, at least two ways in and out, and that does still happen in a lot of the West, a lot of the firefighters, because of the danger of these big fires, they're not even able to go in anymore. So those kinds of things can just be laid down now to keep the worst of the potential problems from showing up in the future. And I think people are getting smarter and getting better.
Can you speak a little bit to how climate change, what this means looking forward, that climate change is contributing so much to the growth of wildfires and changing fire behavior?
Well, it's very sobering to think that since 1983, the number of acres that burn in the West have doubled. And most of that doubling has been the result of climate change. We've had phenomenal increases, of course, in temperatures. So the trend is definitely moving in a direction that's going to make wildfires more common. I am very sobered by the fact that in Colorado, the fire season has now extended about 80 to 85 days just in the last 30 years. In other words, it's not going to be too long before there could potentially be fire risk in some part of the state in every month of the year. But that increase in the fire season is largely because the snowpack is melting off earlier and earlier and earlier, and it's coming around again later and later in the fall. And when that snowpack goes, it's not just a matter of not supplying the water we need, but it's also a matter of drying out the forests earlier in the year and making them vulnerable to the effects of a warming earth. And that's exactly what's going on. So those are just some of the things that are going on related to climate change. And this is not going to change. We are going to have wildfire with us far more often than not for the foreseeable future. So we really do need to get serious about what we do about it.
Gary Ferguson is a science writer for National Geographic and the author of Land on Fire. He discussed changing fire behavior with reporter Elizabeth Stewart Severy. Thanks for tuning in to Airtime on Aspen Public Radio. This week, you heard from reporters Kristen Kay, Elizabeth Stewart Severy, and myself, Allison Bechtesh. You can podcast or stream this show online, aspenpublicradio.org. Airtime is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.